step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Well, three words closed down the three-week trial of Corey Richens. The defense rests. That's it. No witnesses, no counter-narrative, no last-ditch effort to poke holes in 2.5 weeks of prosecution testimony. Three witnesses had reportedly been waiting, ready to take the stand, and they were sent home. A trial originally scheduled to run until March 27th wrapped its evidentiary phase on March 12th, weeks ahead of schedule, and the only words Corey Richens spoke directly to the court during the entire proceeding were to confirm she was waiving her right to testify. 3 weeks, 42 prosecution witnesses, and when it was her turn, she had nothing to say. Before we get into what that means, the standard reminder that applies to everything we do here: Corey Richens is presumed innocent until proven guilty in the court of law. Everything the prosecution has presented are allegations. The jury decides. That's how it works. That's how we treat it. So there you go. It's a lot of opinion that's going to be in this piece. Now, let's talk about what actually happened, because the surface story is interesting enough, but what's underneath it is what I want to get into. And I want to get your thoughts, as we do, in the comments section on YouTube and Substack. So please do weigh in. We do read the comments, and I'd love to get your thoughts. Thursday started with what looked like the prosecution tying off loose ends. Carmen Lauber, the former Richens housekeeper who allegedly obtained the drugs prosecutors say were used to kill Eric Richens, was recalled to the stand. The questioning this time focused on new information about violations of her drug court conditions, possession of a firearm, alcohol, curfew issues. It wasn't a triumphant moment for either side, but it was a reminder of how much of this case has run through Lauber, and how much of the defense strategy has been built on attacking her credibility. Then Detective Jeff O'Driscoll returned, the lead investigator, the prosecution's final witness, the man who's been at the center of this case for 4 years. Defense attorney Kathy Nestor continued her cross-examination, and she landed what seemed a real point. No fentanyl was found in anything tested in the Richens' home, not in the kitchen, not in the mudroom cabinet, where investigators did find a bag of loose hydrocodone pills, tested, came back clean. 4 years of investigation, dozens of search warrants, one recently as last month, and, you know, essentially no murder weapon. I mean, it sounds interesting on paper. You didn't find anything, did you? Yeah, well, here's the problem. They didn't freaking look either. They didn't test. It's not that the test came back clean. They just didn't test. So there's that. Bad, bad, bad police work in this case. I mean, I should stop saying stunning on things like this, because it's really not so stunning at a certain point when this happens all the damn time. Nestor pressed the point, though, directly. And all of that, no fentanyl connected to Eric's death had been found anywhere in the house. O'Driscoll confirmed it. Again, would have been interesting had the police done their job, huh? There's a thought. But because they didn't do their job, doesn't erase the mountain of evidence over here against Corey Richens. Now, this case could have been shut and closed had the police done their job. But again, yeah. And then O'Driscoll said the line that swallowed the whole argument. There was, in his words, a boatload of fentanyl in Eric Richens' stomach that came out of the house with him. So it landed pretty well. it really, it was kind of a good moment if you were on team. Let's get to the truth here. And let's look where the evidence lands. There's no fentanyl. You can't tell where how it was in. What happened to it? Well, he ingested it. That came out of the house with him. Boatloads of fentanyl. A lethal dose of it sitting in the body of a man who, according to everyone who knew him, had no history of drug use. Now, his own wife of many years, who's had many kids with him, seems to want you to believe that, even though there's really no documented way of proving that, along with most of the things Corey Richens says. She has a history of saying things aloud. She has a history of lying to people. A long history of lying to people, being deceptive to people, maybe even lying to herself. The jury heard both of those things. They're sitting with both those things right now. Here's where it got genuinely interesting, and it's a moment that didn't get nearly enough attention. Before testimony concluded, there was a legal argument about a man named David Norris, someone who reportedly claimed that Eric Richens had once asked him about obtaining fentanyl back in 2019. The defense wanted that in. The logic was obvious. If Eric was asking around about fentanyl years before his death, maybe there's another explanation on how it ended up in his system. Reasonable doubt, a thread worth pulling. If there was any legitimacy to the witness. Judge Richard Marzik had previously ruled Norris couldn't testify about that conversation because it is hearsay. But on Thursday, he came back with a precedent that suggested maybe a path forward if you want to pull that lever, Corey. Here's the catch, though, a significant one. If the defense walked through that door, they took the guy off the street, doesn't really have a very documented way of saying this because it is 1,000% hearsay, and Corey has a documented path now through evidence of showing that she's trying to influence witnesses to say certain things. Okay, you want to let that in? We're going to counter that then with testimony from Hayden Jeffs, the Richens family's handyman. Jeffs had reportedly told investigators that Corey was the one asking about fentanyl. That testimony had been suppressed, but if the defense opened this line of questioning, it would come in. The door swings both ways. They didn't like that idea. They, meaning the Corey camp, like, ooh, that's going to make us look icky. Yeah, it's because your client's kind of icky. The judge looked at defense counsel and said plainly, this is a high-stakes poker. The defense team conferred for half an hour, and then they chose not to ask O'Driscoll about Norris at all. In fact, they folded that hand. They folded everything. That alone was telling. But then they went to lunch, and when they came back, they folded the whole damn game. Attorney Wendy Lewis stood up in the court and said, Your Honor, after consulting with our client, the defense rests. The courtroom, by multiple accounts, was caught off guard. Witnesses were ready to testify. The trial had weeks left on the calendar, and none of it happened. Judge Marzik turned to Corey Richens and verified that she was waiving her right to testify, and she confirmed it. It was the first and only time she addressed the court in the 3 weeks of the trial. Now, the conventional legal read on that is that resting without calling witnesses can actually be a defensible strategy, and it can be in some cases. If you believe your cross-examination has done enough damage to the prosecution's case, putting witnesses on the stand only creates new opportunities for the state to score points. You don't want to hand them ammunition if you don't have to. You rest, you take the case to closing arguments, and you trust what you've built is enough. And maybe that's how they see it. I can't be in their minds. That's the clean, professional explanation, and it deserves to be taken seriously. But here's my read. You ready? And I want to be clear. This is my opinion. My opinion. Not a legal analysis, not a psychological diagnosis. Just a pattern that I keep noticing in cases like this one. To take it for what it's worth. And again, I'm not diagnosing Corey. This is my opinion. Look at the profile of defendants who make this choice when the evidence is stacked against them. Specifically, look at the defendants who carry traits associated with narcissistic or borderline personality patterns. And I'm not throwing those terms around casually. I mean people who have built their entire sense of self around a very specific, carefully managed image. People who have spent years controlling how they are perceived by their community, their social circle, their own family. People for whom the story they tell about themselves isn't just vanity. It's survival. It's the thing they've organized their whole life around protecting. When someone like that ends up in a courtroom, something specific happens that goes beyond legal strategy. The courtroom doesn't just evaluate their guilt or innocence. It dismantles their image piece by piece, in public, on the record, with nowhere to go. Think about Corey Richens. Think about what Corey Richens has been forced to sit through over the last 3 weeks. If the prosecution's portrait is accurate, jurors were shown text messages prosecutors allege revealed calculated financial scheming. Her phone's contents, including prosecutors allege those memes viewed the morning her husband died. One about being rich, one about idiots, one about wiping your eyes with money. Laid out for 12 strangers to interpret. A jailhouse letter prosecutors called a calculated attempt to manipulate the narrative was read aloud and analyzed. Her children's grief book, Are You With Me, was examined not as an act of motherly love, but prosecutors allege as a branding opportunity. Emails to a local morning show pitching herself as a segment, promotional talking points, a promo code for viewers who wanted to buy the book weeks after her husband died. Every single one of those things, if the prosecution's framing is correct, represents a version of Corey Richens that is the precise opposite of the version she constructed for the world. The grieving widow, the devoted mother, the woman who turned tragedy into something meaningful for her children. That's the image. And prosecutors spent 2.5 weeks methodically burning it to the ground. Exhibit by exhibit, witness by witness, in front of a jury and a live streaming public audience. Here's the thing about exposure as a psychological weapon against someone built this way, with this type of a personality profile, if you will. It doesn't just hurt. It destabilizes. The image isn't decoration for someone like this. It's the foundation. When the foundation gets attacked long enough, hard enough, publicly enough, the calculus shifts. It stops being about the best legal outcome and starts being about survival. In the more immediate sense, like being able to make it through court. How much of this can I sit here and absorb? How many more days can I watch myself get taken apart in front of people who are recording it and posting it and replaying it? Another week of witnesses, another week of testimony, another week of prosecution redirect and new documents and more things she allegedly said and did being presented to a jury as evidence of who she really is, someone who she really, really protected the world from seeing. At some point, I think Corey Richens looked at that math and decided she was done. Not strategically, psychologically, she hit a wall. That, in my opinion, is what happened in that hour-long recess on Thursday. Not a legal pivot, a breaking point. And I want to be clear, this is not a clinical diagnosis. I'm not a psychologist. This is a pattern I've watched play out in case after case. And it fits here in a way I don't think anyone can ignore. Now, here's the angle also that is not really being talked about. And I think it matters. The attorneys, Kathy Nestor, Wendy Lewis, Alexander Ramos, these are real people with professional lives, reputations, and public identities that exist beyond this courtroom. And for 3 weeks, every decision they've made, every objection, every motion, every cross-examination has been evaluated in real time by a very large, very vocal public audience, true crime followers, legal commenters, social media accounts with significant followings, people who understand enough about law to have opinions and not enough to have restraint. Every evidentiary ruling that didn't go their way got clipped up and posted. Every moment where the prosecution outmaneuvered him got analyzed and scored. The moments where the judge had to step in, where an argument didn't land, where the prosecution found a counter they didn't anticipate, all of it replayed on a loop with commentary. We talk a lot about how high-profile trials affect defendants psychologically. We almost never talk about what sustained public exposure does to the attorneys. Here's what I know about people in high-visibility professional roles who take serious and repeated public hits on their competence. The pressure to stop the bleeding is real. The desire to get out of the spotlight, to not give the audience another week of material, is a genuinely human response to a genuinely brutal situation. These attorneys didn't sign up to become characters in a true crime production. They signed up to defend a client, and somewhere between those two things, the lines got very blurry very fast. Now, I am not accusing Kathy Nestor, Wendy Lewis, or Alexander Ramos of making a decision based on anything other than their best professional judgment for their client. That is not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that attorneys are human beings. They have egos. They have professional images. They've spent careers building. They have a stake in how this ends that goes beyond the verdict. And when you're a human being who has been publicly scrutinized at this level for this long, the idea that those pressures play absolutely zero role in how you weigh risk, that you are a perfectly rational machine unaffected by external humiliation, is not how humans actually work. Maybe resting was the right call legally. Maybe they genuinely believe the cross-examinations were enough. I'm not in a position to say they're wrong. But the idea that we should never examine the very human motivations of the people making these decisions just because they have law licenses strikes me as a significant gap in how we cover these cases. They're not just legal technicians. They're people under enormous pressure with reputations on the line who have been dragged through a public spectacle alongside their client. That doesn't excuse anything, but it explains some things, and it's worth saying out loud. So, here's where things stand. Closing arguments are Monday. Both sides met Friday to finalize instructions, and the case goes to the jury. Deliberations could take hours, could take days. Who knows? Prosecutors are walking into that room with 42 witnesses, a fatal dose of fentanyl, and a man prosecutors allege had no history of drug use, a housekeeper who allegedly sourced the drugs, forged documents, insurance fraud, and a defendant who, according to prosecutors, was pitching a children's grief book to morning television within weeks of her husband's death. Defense is walking in, arguing that the state never produced a murder weapon and that 4 years of investigation came up empty on physical evidence in the home and that their cross-examinations introduced enough doubt to undermine the prosecution's narrative. The jury will weigh all of it, but the image that I keep coming back to is that the courtroom on Thursday afternoon, going back there, the moment Lewis stood at that stand, the defense rests and the room went quiet. Witnesses went silent. Weeks of scheduled testimony erased, and Corey Richens, for the first and only time in 3 weeks of trial, speaks. Not to defend herself, not to explain, not to offer the jury any version of events other than the one prosecutors have spent weeks building against her. She speaks to say she has nothing more to say. Maybe that's brilliant. Maybe that's the right call. Maybe the defense genuinely believes they've done enough damage to the state's case, and the jury comes back and hands them something. Or maybe this is just where I land, and I look at this honestly. It's the sound of someone who's been exposed down to the bone, who has watched the image she spent years constructing get systematically dismantled in public, and who looked at another week of that and decided no more. It's not a legal strategy. It's a person who knows how this ends. Your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube and Substack. The links are in the description. I'd love for you to join us there, Substack. It's absolutely free. There's no paywall. Come join our community. Weigh in. We'd love to hear your voice on this case. And again, YouTube as well. Wherever you're listening to us, if you're not taking us on the road as a podcast, be sure to do so on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get podcasts. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi and press subscribe, and then you got us on the road too. All right, until next time, until we continue our conversation in the comments, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
Welcome to another hour of live true crime coverage every morning, 11 a.m. Central on YouTube. If you're missing it, if you don't get your true crime cup of coffee in the morning anymore over on Court TV, I'm just saying,
daughter,
we're here for you every day at 11 a.m. Central. So please do come join us. We got a lot to get through today talking about the Corey Richens trial. The defense is in the Corey Richens trial trying something bold, putting the victim's past on trial. They're suggesting Eric Richens had a history with drugs and that the fentanyl that killed him may have come from somewhere other than Corey, despite all the evidence that shows that it came from a chain of Corey's housekeeper to the drug dealer. Anyway, that's something else, according to them. His best friend and business partner sat on the witness stand and said he'd never seen Eric touch anything. Joining us to discuss, as always, my co-host, Robin Drake, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, former FBI. And Eric Faddis is with us, former prosecutor and defense attorney. Eric, let's dive in here. The defense wanted to put Eric's alleged high school drug use in front of the jury. Let's put it in perspective here. High school would have been the late 90s for Eric. That's how far back we're talking here. The judge said, nah, we're not going to go back to the late 90s when the original screams were out and whatever you were doing around a bonfire is evidence that gets into this case. That evidence is out. Eric, when a judge cuts off a piece that your defense theory is trying to bring before the jury before they're even able to get it there, no matter how ridiculous it may be, what does that do to their argument and the fact that they're having to reach that far back as well?
You know, best laid plans often don't materialize. And that's what happens in trial. You know, you've got to roll with the punches. You've got a game plan going in. And then there are rulings that come up. There are witness issues that come up. Sometimes there's new evidence that comes up. And so you've got to improvise. You've got to adapt to that. But certainly it's a huge blow to defense because it's kind of central to their theory, as far-fetched as some might believe it to be.
Yeah. And Eric, I was looking at this question when we're, you know, putting everything together ahead of time. And not just that, but so I did this research also, and it didn't take much just because it's all been laid out there about Corey. You would think behaviorally that if there was an issue Eric had with drugs, either he started it back in high school, he'd have to continue this in order for it to be an addiction. And they're proclaiming it a secret addiction. But nowhere did any family member, any friend, Corey herself ever make mention to family, friends, or anything else that there's been a change in Eric's behavior. There's been an escalation. There's been some issues. There's been no suspicions. That's another element of this. How does defense kind of leap over the fact that it's never been claimed before?
You know, I think that's terribly problematic because especially folks who have been around those with addiction issues, especially if you're close to them, it becomes rather prominent and it becomes noticeable and it becomes a problem usually in their lives. And so the fact that no one's ever brought this up, you know, we're just bringing up on the eve of trial, during trial, when Corey Richens is on trial for murder, certainly raises some eyebrows. You know, on the other hand, I suppose if it was a secret addiction and you know, perhaps Corey didn't want to talk about it, perhaps his siblings or his family members didn't want to talk about it, perhaps that's the reason that it hasn't been reported. I think that's the way defense might style it, but certainly suspect.
Do you think this was a planned route they were taking before the trial started of this, or is something they kind of did impromptu along the way as they saw things go? In other words, was it more of a desperation move, you think, on their part, or was it premeditated they were going to bring it up no matter what?
You know, as a defense attorney, you're talking with your client and you're kind of like, hey, what is an alternative explanation for this? If you didn't do this, what could have happened? And my apprehension is that Corey kind of told her attorneys, hey, maybe he had some personal substance issues going on and he did this to himself. And then as the attorney, you have to try to corroborate that. So you're looking for evidence. And sometimes you got to look far back. if that evidence is so attenuated, what is its weight? What does that really matter? And how compelling would that be to the jury that, you know, I don't know, some guy was, like Joni said, doing shrooms around a bonfire 30 years ago or something. Does that mean that he killed himself with fentanyl in this case? That's a bit of a stretch.
So in case, and I'm sorry, Tony, one more follow-up on that. Having to go that far back in the cases that you've been around, is that typical or is that a really super big stretch they had to make on that, do you think?
Oh, it's a super big stretch, and I'm not surprised by the judge's ruling. You know, their judges are not inclined to let the defense engage in character assassination of the alleged victim by bringing up, you know, every potential misstep and wrong this person might have done throughout the decades of their life.
It's like a statute of limitation on stupid.
That's one way to put it. Yeah, we
I got another one today. I'm done. I mean,
and that's a great one. The statute of limitation on stupid. I like that. I like that. It should be a T-shirt. I like it a lot.
It goes with finding calm in the chaos.
Yeah, very much. Very much. I mean, essentially, it's a play on the jury. It's a play on people. It's a play on humanity. And basically hoping that someone out there may have some sort of similar situation in their life that they can relate to and go, oh, yeah, I didn't know about that forever, too, with so-and-so. It can happen. And that's essentially what they're trying to do by just saying, well, maybe it came from somewhere else. Maybe it did. But having some evidence to back that up certainly helps. And when you don't have much, I mean, wouldn't if Eric had some sort of drug issue for all these years leading up, wouldn't that have been like the first damn thing out of Corey's mouth the night he died? I mean, wouldn't that be the thing that they'd be looking at right away? Wouldn't this be like the story that she's screaming from the heavens? My God, you know, be aware of what your partner's into, you know, because for me it was too late. I don't know. I mean, to try and play this card that she was just clueless as to this being a thing whatsoever. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of things that partners can do behind the other's back, and they are clueless to it. But I don't know. This one just seems to be a bit much.
You know, that's what we'd expect, Tony, is that the spouse of a decedent who died, you know, in an inexplicable fashion, appears to be possibly a chemical source of that death. You'd think their partner would be like, gosh, you know what? Like, he was struggling with this stuff and it was escalating and becoming a problem. On the other hand, you know, perhaps she didn't know about it or didn't know a lot about it. Perhaps when this death occurred and she's talking with police, you know, it's chaotic. And then, you know, she doesn't want to disparage her dead husband. And so, you know, maybe those could be speculative reasons why she wouldn't mention it. So it can be played both ways, but the jury's got to decide what's the most reasonable interpretation of how she addressed that issue with police.
Do you think, Eric, that if defense goes down this road when they take over the case, you know, today or whenever, that it shifts to them, that prosecution might, you know, attack it with even things like the call to the medical examiner? Because these are such really good points we're making, that if there was no arc of suspicion, not even confirmation, because I know people can hide amazing things when you have secret place. I've done lots of investigations where family members are completely unaware. But you always have behavior leakage where you're in denial, you don't want to acknowledge it because there's a pattern and escalation of a change over time. And I would think, though, if there was that, like we were saying, if there's that some sort of suspicion going on, people in the family, friends would say, ah, it makes sense now, you know, the hindsight being 2020. And I would think that even that call to the medical examiner might have looked a little bit different. You think they might go down that road on it?
Yeah, certainly they might. And, you know, one thing the prosecutor might bring out in defense's case in chief, if they're sort of riding this horse that, hey, Eric had this drug issue, he overdosed, that's what happened. Well, prosecutor can show an absence of evidence supporting that. They can show, hey, you know, we've got his cell phone. We don't see his cell phone records. We don't see, you know, a bunch of text messages with known dealers speaking in code about, you know, different types of drugs. We don't see, you know, rehab stints. We don't see hospitalizations. We don't see the things you might expect someone who is really struggling with a drug addiction so much so that they overdose themselves. So I think the prosecutor has some traction in terms of how they're going to challenge.
And buying from ranches connected to Mexico and things like that, right?
Well, and who does have the track record of secret coded messages on on cell phones about drug dealers, you know, about the Michael Jackson stuff? Corey happens to have that in her background. I mean, and these are things you can't even argue your way out of. You can't be like, well, that's just malarkey. It's real. It's there. It happened. They can go down this chain of, well, she asked for the Michael Jackson stuff. He thought it was oxycodone. One of them thought it was Oxycontin. The other thought it was, who knows? I mean, nobody seemed to know the damn name of the actual drug. But at the end of the day, the intent is what happened. That's what they procured. She wanted strong stuff, the Michael Jackson stuff. I don't see any other meaning behind when someone says, I'd like the Michael Jackson stuff, other than I want something that's going to kill my husband. I mean, can you interpret that any other way? And I've asked this, I've asked this too, so as a defense attorney, so I'm curious to get your take on it. Does it matter that none of them seem to know exactly what was in those pills, other than it was something very strong that could kill somebody? The fact that they all kind of had different names for everything, does that make a difference that Corey didn't say, I want fentanyl? She got something that killed her husband. It's what she asked for. Does that whole chain of wording, the verbiage, does it matter?
You know, these nuanced issues come up a lot. How do we give meaning to a person's statements at a trial? The prosecution is going to zoom out. They're going to say, hey, look, she wanted some super strong drugs, and then her husband died of super strong drugs. You don't have to be a genius to connect the dots on that. Defense is going to get more granular. They're going to say, hey, prosecution has to prove how this person died, has to prove Corey Richens is connected to that. And if the substances about which Corey Richens was speaking are different than the substances that killed Eric Richens, then is that doubt? Does that inject some confusion, some uncertainty as to what happened, by whom it was procured, and how it was administered? So it's kind of, you know, prosecution zooming out, defense going to zoom in, and then the jury's probably going to land somewhere in the middle.
Is the defense of Corey, is Corey inadvertently displaying a pattern of deception in real time to the jury in this trial? Because it seems like they just keep adding in stuff that really doesn't paint a great picture for Corey, while they're trying to really railroad the dead guy, the victim here, Eric Richens, into this corner of he's having a torrid affair with his best friend, and which is just malarkey. Then is he getting drugs from somewhere else off the street? We can't say who or where or when. We have no evidence to point to that. But whoa, he did some stuff in high school. He was abusive. But we can't prove any of that. There's no track record of any of this or anyone ever saying this, other than when it works to the advantage of Corey Richens to make her look like a victim herself. Everything that is coming out doesn't have any sort of legs to it, and it all points in one direction to make Corey Richens look like a victim when she truly is a victimizer, clearly, in this case, or alleged to be the victimizer. This is not a great look. I mean, is the jury seeing the pattern of Corey's deception just continuing to be exercised in real time as they keep throwing more things into the mix that really don't need to be there? I mean, are they just digging their hole deeper?
You know, I sense a hint of desperation on behalf of the Richens camp, and that's not unexpected. She's on trial for murder, facing significant evidence against her. And, you know, on the legal, you know, you can have sort of a legalistic approach to a trial and say, hey, theoretically, you can't rule out X and Y, so you can't say that she for sure did this. But the jury, they're not professional jurors. They're just normal people. And so they're not going to be evaluating it from such a legalistic perspective. They're going to be evaluating it from, what do I believe? And when you're sort of throwing everything at the wall and seeing what sticks, sometimes the jury picks up on that and they say, whoa, wait a second. If they're selling me some BS on this side, what else are they trying to sell?
You know, Eric, it looks like defense is clearly, at least from our, you know, grandstand optics is losing the battle of character assassination of Corey versus Eric. What do you think, you know, if that was their original plan, was trying to do that, and it's obviously just keeps falling flat that they're having to go back to high school to try to assassinate his character, what do you think they might try to do to adjust to this when they actually, you know, when they try to make their defense and make their points?
You know, you really have to try to bring it all home in closing argument. You have to, even though you don't have a burden on the defense side, the judge wants to be able to place faith in whatever arguments you're making and whatever evidence you're presenting. And so you have to kind of connect the dots, bring it all together, show how it leads to reasonable doubt. But Robin, if you've already lost some credibility with the jury, and this thing's gone on for some time, these jurors are making credibility determinations of the witnesses, but also of each side and of the attorneys. If you've lost that credibility, it's going to be a hard road come closing argument to be, you know, saying things with a straight face, and the jury's looking at you all sideways saying no.
Is there any last play? You know, so say, you know, defense attorneys, they got reps, you have reps, and every time you get a rep, you know, facing a situation like this, you get better at it and better at it, and then you kind of have your playbook on if XY happens, do this, if this happens, do this. And I'm sure it's not the first time these attorneys have faced, you know, credibility issues with their client and it's going sideways like this. Is there a typical thing that they'll roll out the last minute as like the Hail Mary, do you think, on this, that'll kind of hopefully give it that shot so they can help it boost their closing argument? Or, and I know we're ways off from a closing argument, but, you know, what do they typically want to do on an adjustment like this?
You know, you want to kind of end your case with a bang. You want something memorable on both sides, including defense side. And then in closing arguments, some things I've seen in similar circumstances are, defense is going to be real with you for a minute. You know, my client is not a saint. My client, you might not like my client. I've seen attorneys go up there and be like, hey, I don't even like my client. But that doesn't mean that they're guilty of murder. They may have made some questionable choices, might not have been the choices you've made. But the central issue is not whether you like Corey Richards. The central issue is whether the prosecution has proven their case beyond a reasonable doubt. And here are the holes. Here are the weaknesses. Here is what constitutes that doubt. Find them not guilty. That's a common road in closing argument under similar circumstances.
So many questions in this case. We'll see where all of this lands in the coming weeks. Your thoughts in the comment section on our Substack and our YouTube. We'd love to continue our conversation there. The prosecution's case rests on a 3-person drug chain in the trial of Corey Richens, a supplier, a middleman, and Corey. The problem is that the supplier and the middleman both have immunity deals. One of them changed his story. The other changed hers when serious prison time entered the picture. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor here with us to help break all this down. Eric, let's make sure everyone understands what an immunity deal actually means, because I think some people assume it means someone is telling the truth because they have nothing left to gain. Or it might be interpreted as they're spinning a story to protect themselves. Because if they don't tell a story this way, well, there's going to be some negative repercussions for not doing that. That's how the defense is trying to position it. And it's really kind of a somewhat true statement. It's not like that's not true. How do juries typically interpret this sort of a situation where you got folks who are telling a specific version of the story? Because, yeah, they got immunity. Had they not agreed to testify, they'd be in jail. There's clear incentive to tell a version of a story there, true or not.
I think it's a really important question, because I think prosecutors and even defense attorneys see it a lot differently than like a normal juror. I think a normal juror is going to look at that and not all of them, but on the balance, kind of have some cognitive dissonance, kind of saying, hey, wait a sec. Like, you're saying Corey Richens did these crimes, But this other person is admitting to doing crimes, and you're not doing anything to them. They don't have any penalty, or they have a lessened penalty. You know, what's that about? That seems a bit like cheating. That seems a bit like manipulation. That seems a bit like tailoring a witness testimony to benefit one side in exchange for a tremendous benefit to that witness. So that witness has an interest in what they're doing and how they're presenting information and the testimony they're giving. So when I was a prosecutor, I tried to avoid immunity at all costs because I think the jury looks at it kind of with a side eye saying, it seems a little bit shady that this person committed a crime, but you're going to let them off. But you're telling us, hey, you know, throw Gordon to the wolves.
Yeah, it's interesting. I looked up double immunities for cases is actually kind of common. It's not uncommon, but it does affect the credibility. It's like 20-30% of jurors definitely look at credibility of immunity issues as being a problematic for them. And so when you're the prosecutor, are you going to battle, do you think, to bolster that credibility, or are you just going to kind of sideswipe it and go at another angle, do you think?
Well, it's tough, you know, Robin, in this case with the housekeeper, my understanding is there were some, you know, alleged crimes in her background that came out. Right. And so, you know, and as a prosecutor, one thing we would say in closing often is like, hey, we didn't get to pick these witnesses. These aren't like hand selected, you know, upstanding nuns or something. These are the people who are involved in a case. And so I think you have to be real with the jury. I think you have to be like, hey, look, there is this immunity deal on the table, but look at what she's saying and look at how it's corroborated by objective evidence that is not manipulated, that's not subject to immunity.
So do you think sorry, Tony, it's really interesting point you made that I was picking up on that. So it really is not just the credibility of the witness, but a lot of times the skill set of the prosecutor and their ability to really talk very well to the jury. From what you're seeing so far in the case, how the prosecutor is doing with that, do you think?
They're doing reasonably well, you know, but there have been some questionable things in the backgrounds of some witnesses who are key witnesses in this case, including inconsistent statements, prior alleged crimes, and all of that is going to be evaluated by this jury.
Yeah. I mean, there's number one, I want to say this because I think you brought up something interesting, Eric, that I think is the tip of the trial. The tip that if they're listening to us, if they're going, oh, hey, there's an idea we should bring up, like the hair follicle thing. Here you go. Here's another. You're welcome, Corey Richens defense. She should go dressed as a nun. Every day going forward, she should have the full getup on every day she goes in there. You know, what is that called? What's it called when the habit? Yes, the habit. I think if Corey went in as a nun every day going forward, case closed. She's free.
You think?
I don't know if anyone's ever tried that. You know, everybody. You know, because she's looking very
literally the Hail Mary, right?
Literally the Hail Mary. She should do a Hail Mary. She comes in dressed as Mary, and she's with child, and she hasn't had sex with anybody. And that, oh my God, oh my gosh, you
or
get one religious. Were religious nun on that jury? You got it.
Or that she had an epiphany and owning her behavior, being vulnerable and transparent is really interesting.
Found God, and this is there you go. You're welcome,
so,
Corey.
Yeah. So Eric, actually, it's a good question, Eric, on that. So Eric, do you ever happen to hit a point with your client that you have to do something drastic, like say, this ain't working, man. You got to shift up how you're presenting in the courtroom.
Oh, certainly. I mean, the jury is going to be laser focused on the defendant, on how they're reacting to testimony, mm-hmm. their facial expressions, their posture, all of that. And so you got to have a serious talk with the client beforehand about that. And sometimes you can control for that stuff. Sometimes you can't. And you have to kind of play the hand you're dealt. And if you can't, you kind of say, you know, hey, this person is being railroaded. If you've noticed them throughout the trial, they're clearly jarred by this. They're physically affected. That's what you've been noticing. That's a deer in the headlights of an unfair prosecution. That's one way defense could address that.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Tony.
How do you think she's doing so far in the courtroom? I mean, she's looking very very matronly, very, you know, just subdued, very, I mean, it's incongruent with the stories that we hear about her. We hear about this very monstrous, very, I'm stealing money this way, I'm taking out loans over here. There's a lot of like horrible behavior going on. And when you look at her, you're like, she doesn't seem like, if you were to profile her and think, well, what does this monster look like? It doesn't look like, you don't think Corey Richens is that person. Do you think that's working well, or can that work against a defendant sometimes, where it's just so far off base from these stories over here that it really shows, oh God, they're still trying really hard over here to bamboozle everyone. She's trying so hard over here simply because she's looking the way that she's presenting right now. I don't know what you would present, but maybe not super meek, super matronly, super whatever. I don't know, maybe a little more authentic, a little more, I don't know. What's your take on how she's reading to the jury?
You know, Tony, juries hate to be tricked. They're not asking to be there. They're taking time off work for multiple weeks on end in a case like this. And if they think someone's pulling the wool over their eyes, that can influence how they're viewing this case. So I think that, the advice to the client, like you said, is to be real about it. You don't want a presentation that is, a stark contrast from everything else they've done. You want a whole person who might be experiencing a spectrum of emotions and certainly a ton of different varying life experiences. But if that presentation for the client in trial is so markedly different from, the presentation on the body cam, the presentation when she was trying to market her book, things like that, the jury is going to start to say, wait a sec, is this person trying to trick me? And especially on the criminal defense side, that can be the death knell.
Yeah. How do you think her reactions are playing right now? Because we've been getting some Corey reactions to different things, and it's always very much a, are you serious sort of look when someone's testifying? And it could be taken, I mean, the way I'm looking at it personally, and the way I'm taking it is like, are you serious? You're saying this? This can't possibly be true. I can't believe you're lying on the stand about this. That's the words that come to my mind when I see her reactions. And I'm sure that's probably the words that she's trying to implant in the jurors' minds as well with her reactions. And I don't know. I mean, it's reading somewhat authentic to me. But again, we see this track record of her manipulating people left and right. The jurors are going to have to take that into account and go, is she trying to do the same to us?
Totally. And Mark Fry, 4304, brings up a good point in the comments where he says, wasn't there already a complaint about her making faces to the jury? So judges are on top of this. They're watching the defendant because it's improper to communicate some kind of response or message to the jury through your reaction sitting at the defense table. And I've been in trials where the judge has admonished my side saying, hey, look, you're rolling your eyes and you're, having these reactions that are improper because they're essentially giving your response to the testimony without you having to testify. And the jury is not supposed to be subject to that. Mm-hmm. So I think the judge is going to keep a close eye on it. I think her reactions have been pretty reasonable, a little over the top at times. But I'm sure that the judge is keeping a close eye on that because that can get out of hand.
It's interesting on that point, Tony. I've been doing the best I can to watch her in the trial and also the 911 call, all the things that we look at behaviorally, because a lot of people love to jump on the behavior stuff and come to conclusions one way or the other. But in my opinion, she's been okay, as well. I mean, I haven't seen anything really. She's not a Donald Adelson. I mean, that was an easy one. She's not demonstratively over the top, incongruent with what you would expect someone in these situations. And even in the courtroom, to Eric's point, she's being admonished for, doing reactions to the jury. But they're not like incongruent with what a normal person that would typically react like, I think, in those situations. So again, I think a behavior is not something they can really rest on of guilty or not guilty is that the jury's looking at anyway.
Not proper, you said, Eric, not proper to do that. I get it, not proper. But at the end of the day, people are going to make the reactions that they're going to do. I mean, What can the what I mean, and not saying that the judge is because I don't think she's going too far down that road, but she is having human reactions that are congruent with her story, that are congruent with the defense's side of things.
That's a good point.
If you're being accused of this and someone's on the stand making accusations against you, and she's looking like she's insulted, like she's shocked, like, where are you coming from with this? Her reactions line up with all of that, which, okay, if she's innocent, that does make sense. If she's trying to spin a tale, then, well, that makes sense, too. She's trying to get that out there. But beyond just being not proper, what sort of latitude does a judge have to quash any of that other than saying, jury, don't take her reactions into consideration? Do they ever remove the client from the courtroom or the defendant out of the courtroom if they just can't keep their reactions to themselves?
So I was in a homicide trial last year where that the judge claimed that issue kept coming up. And the judge at first said, hey, you know, do I have to make you like face away from the jury during this trial? Like move your seat such that
put him
the jury
in the corner.
Can no longer see you? Yeah, right. And then ultimately, if there is such a decorum violation and the judge gives multiple warnings and the person keeps doing it, that's potentially contempt. And if it's contempt, the judge can remove the defendant from the trial and have them view it remotely. That's an extreme measure for sure. But mm-hmm. I've seen judges threaten them multiple times.
That reaction can have that big of an impact on the jury. And I mean, I think it can. I don't think we're close to that here, but I don't know. It feels like as the water continues to fill the Titanic, from steerage to first class, that the desperation or the reactions that we're getting out of Corey seem to be amping up. So who knows what's going to happen once we get to the defense end of things here. Your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube and Substack. We'd love for you to participate in the conversation. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're getting podcasts. You don't miss any of our conversations on this case. Before the jury ever decides whether Corey Richens murdered her husband, they've already learned a lot about who she is. Her phone showed searches for fentanyl poisoning, how to delete iPhone messages moments after first responders left the house where Eric lay dead. Her phone was used to access deleted memes. One caption, I'm really rich. She allegedly wrote a letter from jail coaching her family on what to say, the walk the dog letter. That's been introduced now, too. A handwriting expert says Eric probably didn't sign his own life insurance policies. 3 days after his death, she was texting about more drugs. Eric Faddis is with us to help us break this all down. Eric, when the defendant has a documented pattern of deception, which they have laid out pretty well here, lying to friends, allegedly coaching witnesses from jail. I mean, she stole roughly $45,000 from a friend for a real estate investment. It was supposed to go over here. It went to Corey's debts, and her friend was just out of luck with that. It paints a really damning picture of someone who really doesn't have a lot of care for other people other than themselves. It doesn't necessarily make someone a murderer, but it really shows what is at the core of their character. How is all of this at the end of the day going to play out in a jury's mind? Is it direct evidence of guilt, or does it mainly hurt her if she actually takes the stand, knowing what her past track record has been with others in this planet?
You know, Tony, there's this legal fixture that judges impose in trials whereby they presume that the jury is going to follow all the jury instructions. Those instructions in part state that, hey, you've got to base your decision on the evidence, not on how you feel about somebody, whether you like somebody or not. But that's not real. That's a fiction. That's not how human beings operate. And so, the jury is going to look at that. And some folks are going to say, gosh, you know, if her character is so shitty and deceptive and manipulative, does that mean she has the capacity to pull this off? Does that mean that she's the type of person who could actually poison their husband and try to get away with it? And I think that's a real problem for the defense. And it's hard to neutralize that, but that is going to be playing in those jurors' minds, whether that's legally appropriate or not.
you know, we don't know what defense is going to do, and, you know, at least we don't know what the witnesses are going to pull. What would be the ideal witness you think they could pull from Corey's life, and what could they potentially say that could offset or at least, you know, put a wedge in that thought process of her just being this horrendous, manipulative person that's taken advantage of all these people?
You know,
conjecture, hypothetical one thing they one. Could,
yeah, one thing they could consider, Robin. So, Corey Richmond's credibility has been attacked. The fact, you know, it's been shown by the prosecution allegedly she's deceptive, manipulative, that kind of thing. So I think the defense would be entitled to put on some character witnesses as to her character for honesty. And so, you know, they could garner people throughout her life, personally, professionally, family members, co-workers, friends, neighbors, things like that, where Corey Richens was a stand-up person and where she was true to her word and where she was consistent in her statements and her behavior. And so I think that they could do some damage control in that aspect, but that assumes you can find such witnesses and they could testify to that truthfully. And that can be a bigger ask than perhaps one might perceive.
Yeah. Have you seen cases where you've had such a preponderance of negative things towards a client and they were actually able to counter for the jury through character witnesses and overcome that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, for example, the homicide case that I did not too long ago, they were saying that my client was violent. And so we put on a bunch of witnesses as to his reputation for peacefulness. And we were able to sort of overcome these harsh allegations by saying, no, you know, look at the people closest to this person. They know this individual's character. They're giving you examples in real life from years ago that occurred before any of this alleged court case was going on. So it wasn't like to try to improve their position or anything in the court case. And so, yeah, there are ways to neutralize it, but it takes a lot of planning, a lot of investigation.
It'll be interesting because even like Lori DeBellavallo, they were completely unable to bring these types of people to court because she was just, and I know one of our listeners has to take a drink now, a nutter.
Nothing like getting drunk before noon, you know?
Because they take a shot every time I say nutter.
And some judges are cautious about letting in that type of character witness. In fact, I've had trials where I've been limited in the number of such witnesses I could put on.
Oh, that's interesting.
So it's kind of a delicate dance. You got to pick your best heavy hitters and try to show the jury the whole person whom they're evaluating.
How damning is the walk the dog letter? They just introduced it. They've seen it now. The jury has gone through it. The explanation that the defense is giving it is, you know, it was a manuscript to a larger 68-page novel. 68-page novel. You know, about it was character development, even though it's like clearly a letter to her mom saying, hey, tell this person to say this, tell this person to do. I mean, I don't really know how you, other than just speaking the words aloud, saying it's a novel, it translates into that. I mean, you might as well say it's a watercolor drawing. It's clearly it's words on a sheet, six sheets actually that say that, but it's a watercolor. No, it's not a watercolor, just like it's not a novel. I don't think the jury's going to buy that it was part of a novel. What else can they do to explain this thing away? And will they be able to?
I think as defense, you've got to kind of own some of your weaknesses. And you might get up there in closing and say something like, they've proven that Corey Richens has terrible judgment. She has terrible judgment. She's sort of unwieldy. She's not thinking these things through. She's an artist and an author, and she's eccentric, and she's making all these weird calls. But she's not on trial for making weird calls. She's not on trial for having bad judgment, and she's not on trial for being bad with money. That's arguable. But I think you kind of go down that route that, hey, this is some sort of, you know, flustered, eccentric person going through some crazy life. life stuff, and that's not the same as witness tampering or something along those lines. That's one way to play it.
Yeah, it's funny, Tony, as you're saying that, it's like character development. The only image that popped in my mind is that, you know, the next scheme that she's going to try to do is personal development coach or Corey
Richards.
Yeah,
she'll be a life coach.
coach Corey Richards.
While selling Amway. I mean, I'm waiting for like the defense to get up there. And by the way, have you heard about this product that can change your life? Corey's going to like show up in a pink Cadillac. She'll be selling Mary Kay.
I like Mark's defense there. My client's an idiot.
it's gone up there like, look, she's, I don't know what the hell she was doing. All valid arguments, Eric. She could do this, they could do that, but I just don't see any of them landing. I don't think you have a way to land that thing. It was never intended to be seen to begin with, and obviously it has been. It's not part of a book. It's damning. It's very damning. But we'll see how that plays with the jury. Another damning thing is her search history. Fentanyl poisoning before they even really knew much about it being fentanyl. How to delete iPhone messages. Death benefit insurance payouts. Some of it can be explained away. Because if your partner died and, you know, you want to get the insurance money you are entitled to, yeah, you're going to look those sort of things up. If you're not familiar with how that works, though, some can be argued as legitimate. But how damning do you think her search history is as compared to some of the other cases that we've seen with, very, very damning search histories, like about dismembering bodies and things of that nature?
You know, it's of course problematic. And if I'm the prosecutor in that, I'm saying, you know, hey, look, let's look at this one search. Okay, this can be interpreted multiple ways, seems suspect, but it's one search. Well, let's look at another search. Well, let's look at a third search. Let's look at a fourth search. And now let's turn to forging financial documents to try to benefit from the death of your husband. Now let's look towards witness tampering. Now let's look towards, you know, you build and build and build and say, hey, even if we take these things in isolation, and there might be multiple reasonable interpretations. When you look at the totality of these things all together, it reeks of guilt. And I think that's how the prosecution's going to style it.
Out of all those things, there's such a preponderance of communication that is not benefiting her whatsoever. You know, what are some ideas that you would have as defense or that you'd be advising them on now? Like, what would you do to kind of counter some of those things?
Yeah, you know, I don't think it would be prudent to put Corey on the stand. That's one way. So you call your client and you have him explain it, but she would be just, crucified up there. So I don't think that's
good. Okay, so let's go down that first then, Eric. So what would be, because I know that's on everyone's mind, will she take a stand or not take a stand? What do you think would be her greatest liability up there on the stand?
I think the search history, and she's got, and you know, they would go in a painstaking way through each and every search. Let's highlight this fentanyl term. Let's highlight life insurance payouts. Let's highlight, and you tell this jury how this does not relate to your husband dying of a fentanyl overdose and you getting paid insurance. Like, and so it's really like you have this trained prosecutor, and then you have this just regular person on the stand who's not used to this scenario. Just being in the courtroom is nerve-wracking, and sometimes it's hard to articulate well in there. And I think you would just let her hang herself on trying to explain away the search history, and then also the requests allegedly of the housekeeper for the drugs, and you just keep, you know, let her hang herself with tripping over her own feet, putting her foot in her mouth and screwing herself over.
Do you think she's going to take the stand? I mean, at the end of the day, Corey has a track record of thinking she's smarter than everyone else. And obviously, it's her choice at the end of the day if she wants to take this in. Her attorneys, I'm sure, are probably saying, bad idea. Don't do this. Don't do this. But at the end of the day, she's the one who seems to swoop in and think she has a solution, like, you know, taking out payday loans to cover bad debts, writing a check to your housekeeper for drugs. That's another fun part of all this that we're learning is that for the drugs, she wrote a check. She wrote and made it out for cleaning, like for an exorbitant amount, which cleaning. Like clearly, if you're going to be buying your drugs and you may have killed somebody with said drugs, I don't know, a check might not be the best route of payment. I mean, it's just, trace it back to me. Here's a way to do it. I mean, she could have denied she ever paid it had she not written a check. But again, just Corey seems to think she has the better ideas than everyone in the room. Is there a world where Corey's going to take the stand here? And is there a way where she can navigate this? She has been able to bamboozle a lot of people in her life. Now, these weren't the brightest folks. We can give them that. Look at the housekeeper. Look at all the folks that have taken the stand that she has bamboozled. The boyfriend seems like a lovely guy. Probably not the sharpest crayon in the box, though, either. So she's selective at who she's able to bamboozle, because I think it requires a certain IQ level to be bamboozled by Corey Richens. But I don't think Corey realizes what that number is in terms of IQ. I think she just thinks the world takes whatever she says and eats it out of her hand. What do you think? Is there a world where she can take the stand here and turn this jury around into her favor?
You know, in the comments, Gen Z thinks she will. And I think there's a reasonable possibility of that. She seems like the type of unwieldy client who is prone to impulsive conduct and is also detached from reality, doesn't realize how her conduct is going to be perceived by other people.
Yeah.
And so I could see her attorneys are like, whoa, 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 you don't need to do this. And I don't think she needs to do it to win. And she might say, you know what, I'm going to tell my story. This is my right. We saw an audacious move by her in sending that letter to her mother. Every jail inmate knows that your correspondence is in and out of jail are going to be monitored. Someone's going to look at this. She did it anyway, sort of in a detached way, probably not foreseeing the damning interpretation that people are going to have from that. Could that same feeling motivate her to take the stand? Very well could.
You know, Eric, you said an interesting statement in there, and that was, you don't think she needs to do that to win. What do you think she needs to do to win?
Yeah, you know, it's not like a self-defense case where oftentimes, you know, the question is whether there was a reasonable fear of imminent bodily harm. Sometimes the defendant has to get up there and say, hey, I was scared for these reasons. That's not the defense here. The defense here is essentially that I think that Eric Richens either accidentally overdosed or committed suicide or something like that. And so I think what they need to do is continue to show any evidence that they have of Eric Richens's drug use, his proximity to drugs, that kind of thing. And I'm not saying such evidence exists, but if it does, I think that's sort of the seed they have to plant in the minds of the jury. And you can do that without Corey taking the stand.
And Tony, I'm just going to add a little bit to what you're saying about the poor mopes in her life. I think there's a lot of good people. She just had a very, very powerful skill set over them. And what happens with every human being is when you have someone that is so toxic like her, like Corey, they're very, very adept at finding your trigger, finding your lever. And I think that, you know.
No. Robin, I did think we lost Robin for a moment there. I mean, it's very interesting to look at the folks that Corey bamboozled, because a lot of folks like, oh, this couldn't happen to me. There's no way that this could happen to me. I couldn't be bamboozled by somebody like this. But people are bamboozled by folks like this every day, especially someone like Corey Richens. Because, I mean, just look at the woman. This is not the person that you think is capable of this list of things that she's accused of. I mean, it's pretty damning. It's pretty bad. And it's easy to put your best foot forward and think that this person could not possibly be capable of doing something like this. Is there anything that she can do at the end of the day here, kind of to what Robin's question was, to try and sway this jury? Reasonable doubt is all they have to get to. How do they get to reasonable doubt here if she doesn't take the stand?
I think they need to engage in some character rehabilitation if they can, if they have the witnesses to do that, to sort of even the scales, to say, hey, look, you heard one side of things. Now you're going to hear the whole story. And so that's one approach. In addition to that, they don't have a legal burden to do this, but they have a practical burden to put forth some reasonable alternative explanation that is not just speculation, that isn't just, you know, he could have died from an overdose. Well, put what evidence there to support that. Yeah. And I'll be interested to see what they put forth in terms of prior substance use, if that happened and if the judge allows it. And then also just sort of really muddying up the waters in terms of the substance itself and what actually killed this guy. If you're going to condemn this woman with a scarlet letter for a murder conviction, you better be damn well sure how they died and from where they got it. And the prosecution can't tell you that.
And the investigation was crap. I mean, the thing is, we're in a world here where two things can certainly be true. She can be a murderer and you can have a really horrible investigation. It happens all the time. But certainly the defense is going to lean heavily on all of the hiccups and all the missteps in this investigation. Is that going to be enough at the end of the day to sway a jury?
You know, in addition to arguing that, hey, there's this confusion around the type of substance that caused the death and from where it was procured and by whom, on top of that, you have the government, who has unlimited resources, putting their finger on the scales of justice by intimidating their own witnesses and ensuring that their witnesses get up there and say what this government wants them to say to condemn Corey Richens and also just let off these other admitted criminals, either scot-free or with substantial immunity. Is this fair? Is this how you think a homicide trial should go? Is this something that you can place enough faith in to condemn a person for the rest of their life? I think they got to hit all angles, and the shitty investigation is a part of it.
Robin, I'll give you the last word here. You were making a point. Why didn't you?
I know. I'm so sorry. Yeah. We lost internet at our house. Okay. It just blipped on us. We're in the middle of a snowstorm in July, it feels like. What was I saying, Tony?
you were talking about the character, I think.
So, you know, it's important to remember, I think, when we're talking about Corey, to realize that people like her that are so adept at manipulation and have lifetime of reps that, there's a lot of victims in this, and victims aren't necessarily people that are weak of character, weak of mind, or easily duped. It's just that people like Corey are such toxic manipulators that they can find these levers of influence over you and wield them very, very effectively. So I want to make sure that, you know, we're not shaming anyone for falling into her trap.
No.
Because she's just got a lot of crazy going on.
Yeah. She's one of those folks. And you look back and go, how? Well, they're out there. Yeah, they are out there. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, as always, thank you so much for your insight on this case. Robin Drake, as always, thank you for your insight on this case. Your thoughts in the comment section, we'd love to see them. Substack and YouTube, the two places you can do just that. We'll continue our conversation there. And be sure to press subscribe wherever you are getting podcasts, whether it be Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever. Hit subscribe so you don't miss any of our coverage and this and the many cases we got for you right here. All right, we'll continue the conversation in the comments. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Ryan Seacrest here. So every great barbecue takes a little patience. And while the food does its thing, you can enjoy a little Chumba Casino. The perfect recipe. Chumba Casino. Always good to have you back.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At ChumbaCasino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At ChumbaCasino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it is Ryan Seacrest here. If you love great games and a little extra excitement to your day, I got something fun for you. Chumba Casino and I have teamed up to create an exclusive online social casino game. It's called Ryan Seacrest 10K Ways. It's fun and free to play, just like all your favorites from Chumba Casino. And every spin brings 10,000 ways to keep the good times going. Check it out and play for free today at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.